Buenas tardes. How's everyone doing today? Thank you so much for attending our seminar, and thank you, Dr. Ramirez and Salud America, for allowing me to have this opportunity to share some of the work that we're doing in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. The work that we're working with Salud America is regarding body image. And I want to disclose that I have no relationships to disclose. Well, first of all, we all know about obesity being a major childhood problem. But let me share a little bit about what's happening in my state, in Texas. So I'm just going to show some charts, and this is just national data and also some data that was conducted by one of my colleagues at the Austin Regional Campus of UT School of Public Health that basically shows that it's a big problem for all age groups, from elementary to middle to high school. And unfortunately, Texas, everything's bigger in Texas. It is bigger in Texas. And as you know, Healthy People 2010 goal is to really only have about 5% of our children to be overweight. Unfortunately, as you can see, it's not so. So let me tell you a little bit about where I'm at. We're located right on the border. Here. Our sister city across is Matamoros, Tamaulipas, and this is the Rio Grande Valley, which consists of four counties, Starr, Willacy, Hidalgo, and Cameron County. If you equate Brownsville, it's equivalent to the Florida Keys, so we're very south. It's a very tropical place. So let me tell you a little bit about where I'm at. About 80% of us are of Mexican descent. Most of us speak primarily Spanish. It's a very underserved population, less than 13,000 per capita income. And 30% of adults between 25 and older have less than a high school education, less than ninth grade. So it's very underserved, low income, as you can notice, there's gonna be a lot of disparities in education and such, which also translates into disparities in health. We've all heard about the ecological models of behavior, and I want to talk a little bit about this because this is how we came about to the idea about body image. So we know there's multiple dimensions and levels that influence behavior. We know that it's very important to know about place and specific behaviors like Dr. Barkin talked about at that family opportunity to do physical activity with young people and at schools like Dr. Sanchez talked about. But we also know that environment directly influences behavior. And then there's the interaction between all of these things that then impact the individual's decision to interact in whatever health behavior we're talking about. But my project also relates a little bit to physical activity, so I borrowed this little diagram from Jim Salas from San Diego State University. It's one of the most popular ones when it comes to physical activity. Another framework that we use at the UT School of Public Health was developed again by my colleagues in Austin at the Michael and Susan Dell Center for the Advancement of Healthy Living, which is a framework for children that really shows that the child's at the center. We all acknowledge there are biological and genetic factors that impact the individual. As Hispanics, we're predisposed to type 2 diabetes, obesity, hypertension, just like our African-American counterparts that have similar, and others as well. So yes, we're not going to deny that there's a genetic component. But we all know that our genes have not changed in the last 100 years. What has changed is our environment, where things are a lot easier for us to be sedentary. So there are other issues that are impacting. Behavioral factors, social factors, personal factors. And that's more of where I'm interested in finding out exactly how these factors influence the individual. But also these are happening in that interaction between the environment of other things, so community policies and food environment policies. You know, we have all heard about the food deserts and things of that sort and other issues. And then of course, major policies at the level. And as public health advocates, I think we tend to forget about that policy aspect. And we really need to remember that it's a cyclical process and it's iterative, so there's different levels always interacting, and we need to think about it as a spectrum and look at different places throughout. So it's just a small little framework of how we started off our project. We're interested in somatotypes. The endomorphic somatopart, the mesomorphic, and the ectomorphic. The idea was that as we talked with community partners, that anecdotally we heard that in this group of Mexican Americans, the endomorphic was something that was acceptable and pleasing because of food insecurity issues, of a sign of wealth and health and other issues. So we wanted to document and really have a better understanding, because if we're going to be giving childhood obesity messages of being physically active, of eating five fruits and vegetables on a daily basis, but individuals are believing that an endomorphic somatotype is healthy, it's not really going to be understood and well received. So we really need to understand what's the best way to communicate some of our health messages. So we really wanted to have a better understanding of what exactly was happening. So of course, we're very we learned a little bit that the endomorphic somatotype might be perceived as healthy. We have a very well-defined Latino population of Mexican Americans there along the Rio Grande border, and we really wanted to know a little bit more about the cultural beliefs of Mexican Americans when it relates to body size and body image and physical inactivity and what obesity means overall. So the goals of our project was really to characterize exactly what it means to be healthy regarding body shape and body size across three generations, the child, the parent, and the grandparent, because as we know, all three generations are very important, and the grandparent and parent are very influential in how individuals make decisions. So we needed to know what was exactly being passed through from generation to the generation. And then obviously, since we're very interested in and then using this information to communicate physical activity messages, starting off, we need to talk about nutrition as well, but you can't do everything all at once. So we wanted to start off with physical activity. We wanted to see what was the association between body size, body shape, and how that relates to physical activity in this group. So we were working with a colonia, and basically a colonia is an unannexed community where services that we get on a daily basis are not necessarily offered to the community members, like garbage pickup and sewage and electricity, things of that sort. So yes, this is United States, but it does seem a little bit like a third world country. And within this colonia, and as I mentioned to you before, about 80% are Mexican American in the Rio Grande Valley, and this colonia is almost about 100% are Hispanic. There are about 7,000 residents, half and half male, female. The median age here is of 21. In Texas, is 32. So Hispanics, as Dr. Ramirez mentioned, we're a large population that's growing, but we're also very young, and it's very evident here as well. And as you can see, the median household income is even much less than that in Texas. And as I mentioned, in the Rio Grande Valley, the per capita was 13,000. Here, it's even less. So as you can see, it's a very low income, disadvantaged community. However, and here are just some images of the community. One of the homes, stray dogs, so there's a lot of policy issues that need to be addressed, and just simple homes. So as you can see, there's a lot of work that needs to be done, but we wanted to be interested. So what first we did is we did some community-based participatory research methods of working with our partners to see more or less what some of the ideas were available. And we were able to work with an assisting community partner, Proyecto Juan Diego / Proyecto Digna, which is a major group there in the colonia that really tries to improve the well-being. And by well-being, I just don't mean the health, but well-being of education, providing GED classes, information about citizenship and other issues of that sort, as well as information about type 2 diabetes and other health issues. And the idea is to recruit 210 families from that colonia. And here's our community partners' offices. We were very interested in having the idea of what individuals thought. We used different stimuli, figural stimuli, to have what young people think. And we needed to create questionnaires that were appropriate for different age groups. So elementary kids, boy and girl, middle school kids, boy and girl, high school kids, boy and girl, and then the parent and grandparent of whatever that gender of that child is. So quite a few questionnaires that we had to go through, and we did an iterative process to make sure we got it right. Our survey items also included other things. Obviously, we were also interested in physical activity, since we talked about that, demographic information, and acculturation, and we used the QAR scale for our survey items. And also some information about eating behaviors and food insecurity, since we had some ideas about that as well. We also are doing objective measures. We are obtaining height and sitting height of all children who are participating, their weight to calculate BMI, and we're also doing percent body fat with the Tanita. And then from a subsample, we're going to be assessing their actual physical activity levels through the use of accelerometers for some of these kids. And here are just you know, the stadiometers and the Tanita, just so you can see the measures, and some of the children who are actually being measured. And so let me tell you a little bit of some of the issues that we've encountered. First of all, we needed to establish our promotora, or our community lay health workers, to be trained to properly do these things. Because when we were doing community-based participatory research, we really wanted to get individuals who were from the community so that it would be easier to facilitate some of the communications that we were doing. It took us quite a bit to do the survey and the protocol because we needed to pilot test it. We pilot tested it with other promotoras from the community who were not part of our study sample and who were not going to be part of our study as well. And one of the biggest things that we realized was that there were many scheduling conflicts. Between the organization that we were partnering with, also we also were able to partner with one of the churches, and they too had some issues because they were teaching Sunday school classes, and sometimes they would allow us to go to their classes, but sometimes it was a little bit difficult because they really needed to be able to get the parents in to talk about the First Communion and other things that they were doing. One of the other things that we realized is that although my community partner and myself were on very good terms and very familiar with each other, and her overhead staff member and my staff members were familiar with each other, the individuals who were in charge of specific groups and my staff members were not very well known to each other. And as you know, with CBPR, you really need to establish some of these relationships and really have a good communication with them. So we spent quite a bit of time establishing these relationships among at the lower level of the staff. So you need to think about these things as well. So just wanted to remind you with CBPR, it's important that not only are the people who are running the show, but everyone that's really involved. And I think sometimes with CBPR, we tend to think that we're doing a good job, but there's still so many things that we need to learn. So those were some of the things. So I want to emphasize more some of the policy, because it seems more that my project is really not at the policy implementation stage. It's more at the policy informing and getting some information from the community members so that we can make changes, especially with our community partner, Proyecto Juan Diego, who's working with us. So we were able to do that. One of the wonderful things is that our community partner is also one of our community advisory board members of our export, or now the Center of Excellence grant that we have, that's again looking at type 2 diabetes, basically a cohort of seeing what's the progress of what's happening with the adults in the community. We also have a community-wide campaign that has different health messages for the adults. And then we also have a prevention project that we're doing to reduce screen time behavior among 9 to 14-year-olds. And so it's good that the partner for our Salud America project is also involved as a community advisory board. So they do have a large influence in making different policy changes, not only within their own organization, but also with organizations throughout the Rio Grande Valley, and more specifically through the city of Brownsville. So our project is more in that stage. I just wanted to include the RWJ childhood obesity logic model to really reverse the trend of childhood obesity by 2015. And our project really is over here at the beginning, where it's fielding and building information of learning more about what leaders and community members want to do to make some changes, and really building the evidence for what works, because it is a large spectrum that we're at, and we're all working at it at different places. My project is more at the beginning. This is a logic model developed by Dr. Audison, who's in the audience, that really talks about the science, the policy, the evaluation, and the public. So basically what does this mean? It's talking about translational research, how we're putting what we know and understanding into action. And here, for our project, we're doing more of understanding the causes and consequences, what the parents and grandparents may do and say to influence what children are thinking. And perhaps, you know, our messages of health promotion, of being physically active and eating healthful foods may not be the best way of communicating if we are not using the correct terms or what's being understood by some of the kids and what the parents and grandparents are trying to communicate. We'll also be able to help spreading and describing some of the things and reframing the issue. And most obviously, perhaps the community members were not quite aware that childhood obesity is an issue if they're thinking that an endomorphic body shape is healthy. So we're bringing that awareness of asking these questions by not even doing intervention, but just asking questions and helping mobilizing the community to perhaps making some changes once we are done with our project and sharing some of the information with our community partner, to perhaps making small changes within their meetings. Perhaps what can then happen is they might do a 10-minute physical activity break with the Muévete video that Salud America has established, rather than doing a 10-minute coffee break. You know, so there's different things that we are trying to do. So we're at the beginning spectra, part of the spectra, which then can then be mobilized into the science and the policy and evaluation. So it's just one part of the whole translational aspect of it. So that's basically what we're at the science. It's the groundwork that we're doing, finding out more of what people are thinking and understanding so that we can really better tailor our messages to what they want. We're also informing the policy by really looking at the evidence, what's happening there, the consequences and things of that sort. And then obviously bringing awareness and alarm to the community as overall. And then I just wanted to share some pictures of some of the data collection that we've done. We just had a major push of data collection last week. I believe about 75 to 100 families were given the survey, and we were able to obtain some of these measures. So we'll be looking at the data cleaning in the next couple of weeks and just some of the different community members doing the survey there. And then we're very proud of this family because this is the very first family that we were able to get the grandparents to be part of the project. We want to know what grandparents think, but unfortunately in the Rio Grande Valley, there's a couple issues that we're having with grandparents. First, literacy. Many of the grandparents have low literacy. And we cannot ask family members to assist with the survey because then that's going to bias what some of the grandparents might be communicating to us. So we had to retrain our promotoras, our community lay health workers, to really assist with administering the survey rather than it being a self-administered survey. It's now becoming a promotora-administered survey. And the other problem that we're having with many of the grandparents is that some of them may be undocumented. And of course, unfortunately, in this environment, many individuals are afraid of any institution or any government agency, and they immediately believe that you're going to report them. And I always tell them, we're not interested in, you know, what your paper status is. We only want to know what you think, and that's more important to me than anything else. So those are a couple other challenges that we encountered. So we're very proud of this family where we were able to get the grandparent, the parent, and the child. And then just to summarize basically that we're talking about translational research and how policy really impacts all aspects from forming ideas and then really putting that into action, is that we know that childhood obesity is multifactorial. But that also means that the solutions are multifactorial. And that we're working not only at the individual level, but also at the societal level to really make an impact, as my colleagues talk to you about what they're doing with schools and families. And so we really need to think about this as a public health approach. You know, I'm preaching to the choir. And that we all have a collective responsibility. No matter what we do or where we go, you know, we need to role model these behaviors on a regular basis. And then, of course, I need to thank all the individuals who have been key players, in addition to Salud America and RWJ, the Proyecto Juan Diego, all of my promotoras, and I'm very fortunate that I also have some undergraduate students from the University of Texas at Brownsville Southmost College who are also participating in the data collection, which are down here. And just want to say thank you so much, and here's our contact information, including my co-PI, Dr. Jennifer Gay.
Amelie, can you help me get back to that slide while I warm up to the topic here? I didn't put slides up because I wanted people to think I was at least listening and reacting to the presentations and not to the background that I've had the pleasure of having about these projects. My compliments to all three of you. Those were superb presentations. You too, Amelie, for being able to encapsulate in a matter of minutes the richness of this project, and all of that by someone as intensely and passionately involved in the details of all of these projects and more than a dozen others. So you got in the introduction from Amelie a review of the epidemiological reality that these projects are about, the trends in obesity and overweight, particularly in the Hispanic populations of America, in contrast to some of the other racial and ethnic populations. She described the rationale for Salud America and how it has evolved through a Delphi process in which priorities were established by polling the leadership in the field, the investigators in the field, people who are concerned about this, as to what should be the top priorities for research. She gave you a sense of the priorities for the project overall in, number one, nurturing the talent that is out there to develop this field. And nothing could be greater testimony to the success of that priority or purpose of this program of research than to note that Dr. Barkin has, since receiving this grant and getting underway with the pilot project she described, has received a multi-million dollar grant from the National Institutes of Health to carry on in this work. We can hope for as much for most of the other grantees. So our compliments to you and congratulations, Dr. Barkin. The other major priority that Amelie alluded to was identifying promising strategies for programs directed at the Hispanic populations of this country. And I think you saw some splendid examples of that in the other two presentations, and I want to just highlight a few of those and then come around back to this slide that Dr. Barroso shared with us to talk about the evaluation of these projects from the perspective of what implications they will have for policy, for local policy, particularly illustrated by Dr. Barkin, for state policy, especially as illustrated by Dr. Sanchez, and for our broader understanding of the physiology, the cultural perspectives on obesity of this population, as illustrated by Dr. Barroso. Dr. Barkin shared with us the three pillars of the conceptual approach that she and her colleagues have taken in Memphis: the built environment, exposure to the built environment and the advantages that we can create in it, family participation in that environment, and the values, beliefs, and perceptions that tend to surround those as people are exposed. These represent in some ways three levels of an ecological model that all three of the presenters showed us how they are applying in their respective projects. The compelling results from the pilot study that Dr. Barkin shared with us have every potential to influence local policy. And if you have any illusions that national policies and state policies are better than local policies, let me share with you a statistic from the great public health success story that tobacco control represented in the last third of the 20th century. There was a point just before the true acceleration of the decline in smoking in the last two decades of the 20th century when there were policies being passed right and left in local communities, smoke-free policies. And these policies, something like 90% of the policies proposed at the local level were passing, whereas 90% of the policies proposed at the state and federal level were failing. They did not pass. And that difference was so compelling for an understanding when we are working on a problem like obesity or smoking, where there is a tremendous industrial marketplace force working on the other side of the equation, that they can mount powerful lobbying efforts at the state and federal level, but they can't put out the thousands of brush fires that we can start at the local level. So local policy is our best hope for getting traction and getting momentum in an area such as this. The conclusions that she came to, I think, are also very instructive. That a systematic introduction to a particular built environment, in her case, a fitness center, a recreational center, where people can get physical activity. A systematic introduction to that can change perceptions and beliefs and values, especially if that can be reinforced with the safety concerns that people have about their children being spending much time in such environments. Policies should be able to build on these findings and others, and we look forward to seeing that understanding diffuse. Dr. Sanchez gave us a splendid example of state policies and how they are playing out as, in effect, unfunded mandates. The law in California that provided for 200 minutes of physical education per 10-day period has been implemented by a small proportion of all of the school districts in the state. I think it was 9,579 complied, 51,238 have not complied. That's a law, and it is not being effective. So we can pass laws. We can pass laws locally and state level, but if we don't enforce them, we're not going to get the effect that they're intended. So don't have the illusion that just passing a policy is a de facto accomplishment of its intended effects. I think the statistic that Dr. Sanchez came to an odds ratio of 1.35 between those schools that had complied with this policy and those that it had not is very powerful. And even after controlling for all of the socioeconomic factors associated with those compliant and non-compliant schools, the ratio held and even crept up a bit. That is very strong medicine for getting such policies passed, and it ought to be used also to get them enforced. Unfunded mandates, then, is one of our big problems in policy development in this field, as in others. Dr. Cristina Barroso gave us a very nice representation of what it's like on the border, in the Colonia, and in the cultural transition that populations in such regions are going through. I can't help but think about her presentation in the broader perspective of Darwin's famous quotation that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, by which he meant that if we look at the life history of a fetus in most mammals, we note that the changes that occur in the fetus are mirror images in some ways of the changes in the phylum from which we emerged over the centuries. And I couldn't help but think that maybe her title should be Somatotypology Recapitulates Genealogy. It seems that's where you went. The endomorphic ideal, because of food scarcity and food security issues in the colonias, is undeniable and something that we need to understand along the lines that she has pursued so well. Very admirably, she has employed a community-based participatory research approach. She's engaged the promotoras. She's had collaborative relationships with a church and with another community organization that is concerned with the broader well-being of the population. All of those, I think, bode well for the ultimate product of her research. A lot of practical, real-world lessons have flowed from that experience. She also shared with us this slide that comes from a work in which Judith Otteson and I, Judith is in the audience, were asked by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to consider and develop as part of an evaluation of the first 5 years of the healthy, active living research program that they fund through San Diego State University, Jim Salas, whose work you saw on the slides as well. Salas and his colleagues administer a grant program much like the one that Amelie is administering at San Antonio, but theirs is focused particularly on the built environment. About midway through that evaluation of the first 5 years of the Active Living Research Program, we made a presentation to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the president of the foundation interrupted us about halfway through the presentation and said, "What about policy impact?" Well, we got the message loud and clear. That was what really matters to the foundation in the long run, is whether you can show that there is staying power from the results that are coming out of this project. So we retreated and drew from the literature this representation of the science policy public evaluation spectrum, or spectra, because we've got many dimensions to it here. And we started, Judith in particular, interviewing each of the projects and examining their reports to understand where they were on these spectra in policy development, policy enactment, policy post-policy enactment. And it turns out that most of them are, in fact, working at one end or the other. They're either developing the knowledge you need to get a policy, or they are evaluating the application, as in Dr. Sanchez's case, of a policy that has been passed. And in a few rare cases, such as two of them you heard today, Dr. Barkin and Dr. Barroso, you're looking at and Dr. Sanchez, all three of them, you're looking at a combination of the two. Projects that are getting the information that policymakers would need to pass policy or to revise policy, and examining policies that have been passed that would be useful in amending the policy, strengthening the policy. And we ended up referring to this, Judith coined it, I think, the Sanchez loop, because it was Dr. Sanchez that helped us understand it in the first instance. That is, we can evaluate existing policies, and that helps us understand what needs to happen in the next iteration, the next generation of policy development. I'm particularly enthusiastic about how these projects are also stimulating public awareness, which, you know, the ecological model has caused some people to think that individual education and mass education are not so important. We've got to be much more concerned about the outer circles of the ecological model. But in fact, if you don't have an educated, informed electorate, you're not likely to get policies passed in the first place or policies adhered to in the second. And so all of the circles in the concentric circles of the ecological model are equally important, and they're synergistic in their relationships. An informed electorate, an alarmed electorate, an outraged electorate is part of what we have to create if we are to make a dent in the obesity epidemic as we did so successfully in the tobacco control epidemic. My compliments to all three projects, and good luck in continuation, and we'll now hope you'll have questions for them.
Yeah, I'd like to ask the panelists to come up and we'll take any questions.
Larry, thank you very much for that eloquent summary and staging of each of these different projects. And as you can see, our 20 pilot projects are really at different stages, but we needed to start this area of research to inform our communities. So with that, I'd like to open it up to the audience to see if you have any questions that you'd like to ask of our panelists. Yes.
I'm familiar with Frontera de Cameron Rod and Juan Diego, because I go down there a couple of times a year with Frontera de Salud. And I know that there is a good core of promotores already very active in that community. So I'm wondering, did you partner with them for your promotores, or
we use them as the pilot study people with the survey. So they pilot studied, we created our surveys with all the figural stimuli with the survey items regarding acculturation and demographics, and had them review the materials and pilot test it with them so they could tell us what worked and what didn't work. We're working with Sister Phyllis from Proyecto Juan Diego and such to actually recruit participants. But my promotoras actually come from the Mano Mano organization, which is really working with the Brownsville Community Health Center, which is a federally funded clinic for underserved populations. So we are working with them, but on a different level. Okay, all right, thank you.
Yes. Go ahead, right here. Okay.
With your, with the adults that you were trying to, with the low literacy rates, how long did it take to implement that survey? How many questions? I currently do a program with oral health education with parents, and I find low literacy rates to be my biggest barrier. I've almost, have you implemented pictograms other than just the scale of?
Yes, actually, I'm glad you asked that question. Thank you so very much. Well, obviously, the figural stimuli are images, which helps to understand what we're asking. Some of the other items regarding quality of life and other healthcare issues are also little images, cartoon schematics, that were from a previous study. I'm more than happy to share that material with you if you give me your information. And some of the other items were just based on what we did with the promotoras from Proyecto Juan Diego. We really changed some of the wording to make it really appropriate for that community. And so the survey itself is about 50 items, but it's quite a bit because of the images, more so than anything else. So very simple, both English and Spanish items. But I'm more than happy to share what we have with you. Yes, we actually are giving incentives to the child, the parent, and the grandparent. Very limited because it's not a large study, you know, it's a pilot study, so, but we are doing things, and we're also giving other information to them and whatever we can, you know, we can borrow here and there and give them what we try to do, but we're all giving all participants a $5 gift card.
And they show up for the $5 gift card?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and I just wanted to add, our researchers are doing amazing things with little money. Yeah, yes.
I was interested in the survey of the school districts that complied, and I wondered what you knew about the characteristics of those school districts that did not comply.
Thank you for the question. I have data on that. I didn't want to show it here because there's just limited time, but those that did not comply tended to be districts that had lower socioeconomic resources. That was a critical component of that, and that's the biggest difference. But we also compared the districts for which we had compliance data for and districts that we didn't have compliance data, and there were also differences between those two. So that led us to think that the process of compliance review is not as straightforward as we understand it is. It's supposed to be an objective process where all these districts are selected based on certain characteristics, but we still saw that there were significant differences in terms of school size, in terms of racial composition, and so on.
Right.
I completely agree with that, and I think that should be a next step to really try to understand why, you know, what is it about the school districts that comply compared to the schools that do not comply. So I think that we need to understand both the determinants of compliance and also non-compliance.
Discussion about
No, I agree, and because we're using secondary data, we're limited by the information that we have, but yes, I agree that, for example, I know that the PTAs may play a very large role. I know in my daughter's school in San Francisco, she attends public school in the city, and the PTA is extremely active with fundraising, and that's why she gets 2 days of physical education every week, and the sessions are quite rigorous. She taught me how to do this, how they did it, and I was actually quite exhausted. So there was another question.
Okay. Yes.
I love this question. So, and just to make sure everybody else heard it, the question was, we recognized in our participants that they wanted very much that feeling of being welcomed when they came in. What did that translate into in terms of training? And especially in the pilot site where we worked, it's the most diverse region in Nashville. It is, many people who worked there were not bilingual, and they felt afraid of cultures that they couldn't speak their language. It was a different take, I think. Usually, we might view people differently than that. They felt that they didn't know. If I don't know the language, how can I engage with them? And so we sat down with them and we said, what are the key things that you think are important when you walk through the door yourself to feel welcomed? That someone says hello to you, and that you can easily find materials that are really health literate, numeracy, really quite easy to understand. You don't have to read at high levels. You need to be able to get a quick graphic to understand how to utilize that center. And so then we worked with them. We gave them a list of welcoming words so that everybody was greeted when they walked in. It impacted not only the Latinos who utilized the facility, but everybody else. We have a huge Kurdish population. We've got a large Somali population. Our fastest growing population over the past year is Burmese. So it helped all of these cultures because they've learned basically a very small list of welcoming words, and then we helped them as sort of an indirect benefit of all of these projects that we've done together by creating materials that weren't language specific.
Did Parks and Rec help by holding your exact accountant? Because lots of times you do kind of excellence training in terms of customer service, and it's only as good as the accountability that's set up for the staff.
So the question is about accountability. These things sound good. It seems like we should all be doing them. How do we hold people to that higher standard? And fortunately for us, our partner in all of the work we do, we are working with the local policymakers, but we're also working with the director of Metro Parks and Recreation and the associate director who's responsible for all the programming. So they are at every single meeting, and we never come up with an idea to foist upon them. We say, how would you like to approach this? What do you think the goals will be? So they come up then with a strategy that lives on whether we have grant funding or not. Thank you.
Yes. One more question for you.
What do you think is the essential part of your intervention that makes it so powerful?
What's the essential part of the intervention that makes it so powerful? I'm a big believer that the best answers are simple ones, even though we recognize these are complicated, complex challenges that face us. As so well articulated by my colleagues in their presentations. And what I believe in this particular work has been most powerful is something very simple. It's how you teach people to walk through the doors and use their built environment. And we didn't have this hypothesis going into it. We noticed by observing and being curious, that it seemed that there were many people who spoke all kinds of languages on the playgrounds, and all of the parks and rec centers have playgrounds, but we didn't see them walking through the doors. We just watched. And then we asked them. We went to the playground and we said, well, it looks like you use the playground pretty often. How often have you walked through the door? And for the Latino community in particular, that number was so low. In other cultures, they were more willing to walk through a door not knowing what was on the other side, but the general sentiment was, this place is not really for us. And so we came up with a systematic methodology of getting them through the door. And just coming through the door, I wish that we had measured this. You know, how many times you have to walk through before you feel really comfortable? Probably more than once, but not more than five times. People started to get comfortable with, oh, here's the person who knows me, and that's where I get the information.
Any other questions? No? One more, okay.
Well, that's the long goal term of this pilot study. We first need to have a little bit more documentation of exactly what people are thinking regarding body size and body image, so then that we can tailor these messages that are appropriate to what this community believes. So that's exactly my long-term goal, is to really see how we can use body image and body size and body shape to make childhood obesity messages that are appropriate for the community. So that's part two. Once I'm done with this part, that's the part two. So but we can chat afterwards, perhaps, and start working on something now. Thank you.
Thank you. The stereotype in our community, que el niño gordito es el niño sano, and so we're still working on trying to change that particular image. So, well, I want to thank, we had a wonderful group of panelists. Thank you all for your wonderful presentations and for being here. And we had a great audience. I know it's lunch and a competition of other sessions, so thank you all for coming this afternoon. Thank you.